Get ready, get comfy for the next Nonprofit Insider Podcast episode.
What's going on, everyone? Another episode of the Nonprofit Insider Podcast, and you are in for a treat today. We're talking cookies, cakes, ice cream. Amir Barger is here on the show. So listen, we're going to get to her in a second. Be sure, you know the deal, TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn. You can find her in a lot of these places as well. And this is a very, very big episode because this is the YouTube video premiere. Listen, Amir, I've been telling, my son's actually the one, he's been telling me that you gotta be on YouTube. You got to put some videos up, and he's 10 years old, so he's the intro to the podcast, so wise words from here, from him. I'm joined today, Amir Barger. Let's freaking go. She's got a book, and people will not stop talking about it because it's exactly what the industry needs, something that we've been looking for a long time. She's an author, professor, woman of the year. She has a lot of belts behind a lot of names and a lot of acronyms behind her, but she is an amazing person. We're joined with her today. Amir, how are you doing? How you feeling?
Doing well. I'm just glad to be here. I'm glad we were connected by FISA over at CVA. Mm-hmm. And I know we've been, following each other on the socials. So I'm just glad to be in conversation with you to start and kick off this new year, 2026, ahead of us. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you're hot right now. A lot of people are mentioning your name. They're seeing your face. That they're getting your voice, your words, your wisdom. You're famous now? Is that fair to say, or what? How does that feel?
Maybe. I definitely had those moments suddenly where you're out and someone recognizes you. I was actually at a conference, and I was standing in line to see another author that I love and think is famous, and someone in line like gasped and like called me. I was like, oh my God, it's you. You're here in person. So I'm starting to have those moments. I still just feel like a regular gal, just living my life, but I'm glad people are resonating. And I love when people stop me on the street or even in the digital streets to say hey and talk about all of the things, including the book.
Well, I think a lot of people see a lot of themselves in you, right? Inspirational in so many different ways. When you're talking about, MBA, CVA, when you're talking about being a professor, when you're talking about being an author, these are a lot of things that people aspire to. So I think there's just a level of resignation. People gravitate towards you like the sun. So I'm excited to have you here on the show and talk about some things. And let me start with this, because you have a network of people in all areas of the nonprofit space.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from people in the industry, the nonprofit space right now, as you've been touring the country?
I think it's because there are a lot of things converging right now, but what I'm hearing most is not just exhaustion. And I think there's a lot of that from many facets of life, particularly in a U.S. context, but also a lot of moral fatigue. I think the words and the way we describe things matter. And I feel like that's what I'm sensing and having so many conversations with people about right now. People are tired in our bodies, yes, but more than that, we're tired in terms of like our values. And I hear so many versions of the same sentences everywhere of like, I still believe in the mission and what we set out to do, but I'm not sure I recognize myself, my community, my country, or some of the people around me anymore. And, nonprofit folks are carrying the weight of the world. It's sort of what comes with the territory, right? The whole sector of nonprofits exists because there's a gap, and yet there are fewer resources. I mean, we're always resource strapped in terms of people and dollars. But right now I feel like there's also more scrutiny and shrinking margins like for error. And we're being asked in nonprofits to do more harm mitigation with less power, less funding, less psychological safety. And I think many people I talk to feel trapped between sort of urgency of the need and the people that rely on the work we do, but also fear. And there's that urgency, of course, to respond to real suffering that is now, that people can't wait. They need something now. But there's this fear also for those of us in nonprofits of losing funding, access, political cover, or coercion. And sort of this metaphor, I think in metaphors and story and picture, but I keep thinking back to like the plate spinning, right? Nonprofit leaders and staff are spinning plates that are labeled like mission, funding, staff well-being, community trust, compliance, optics, and you know, no one is seemingly allowed to let a plate fall. So instead of asking, you know, which plates no longer serve the mission, I think people are spinning faster and that's not sustainable. And that's how burnout becomes normalized. So people are asking me, you know, underneath all of this, how do we stay principled without burning everything down, including ourselves, which is a hard dichotomy to live with in the moment right now, I think.
Yeah, moral fatigue. I haven't heard of it. I haven't heard of it in that particular fashion, but just hearing you say it and the way you explain it, I think a lot of people, a lot of our audience can recognize that. They can have that feeling of, I'm working with the animal shelter, I'm doing advocacy work, I'm a social worker, and having that different aspects of where my values may lie, what's going on in the greater world, burnout. I want to talk to you a little bit later about burnout, because that's something I think that you could probably really speak to. And I want to come back to the nonprofit industry here in a bit, but I want to learn a little bit more about where your head's at these days, because, again, you've been touring, you're going around, you're talking to a lot of different individuals, and I feel like, at least for me at this moment in time, Amir, I've been having a little bit of a real epiphany as of late. My life, love, the future, parenting, kids, our parents, being parents, the things that kind of come with it. And it's funny because I've been saying to myself, I don't feel like I'm in a midlife crisis because I'm 38 years old. I don't feel like I'm in a midlife crisis. Oh. I feel like I already had that. But I have almost like a grounding feeling of understanding where I'm at in life at this moment in time. And it's eye-opening, and it's also kind of scary at the same time. So you don't have to tell us your age, but how are you feeling right now? Because it feels like so many of us have like a little bit of unwanted dread.
Yeah. No, this is, I feel like I'm in a similar space. This 2026 is year 40 for me of life, four decades on this earth. And, you know, this is such a generous question because I think so many of us are having sort of like this quiet reckoning. And for me, I grew up on a tiny island. I talk about that a lot. I grew up on the tiny island of Guam, which is like 30 miles long, 8 miles wide. And so one of the things that I'm thinking about sort of in this moment of how I'm feeling right now is this time of life feels like standing at low tide on the beach, you know, when the water sort of pulls back and suddenly you can see everything on the ocean floor, like what's beautiful, what's broken, what's been there all along. And there's clarity for me right now. And clarity, I think for many people, can be scary. And I think it's, you know, around what you have clarity of. And I feel less interested in like proving and performing or pleasing, and so much more interested the wiser and older I get in alignment, and more interested in asking, like, what am I willing to pay for with my time, my energy, my nervous system? And the dread that I or other people are feeling, you know, isn't random. It's information. It's grief for systems that will never, for some of us, never worked. And for some people, suddenly no longer work. It's fear about, well, what comes next? And what can I do and affect in terms of change? But it's also a signal that, you know, those old rules, they aren't holding. And for me, I don't feel panicked. I feel very awake, and awake can feel, for some people, if you haven't had that sort of reckoning, it can feel destabilizing before it feels grounding, which I love that word that you use, grounded, but getting to grounded starts with destabilization often. And so I think another metaphor I'd offer for your listeners and watchers here is that we're between stories right? The old story is collapsing and the new one hasn't been fully written. And that in-between space is uncomfortable, but it's also where choice lives and where change begins. And so I would encourage people, sort of where I am right now, of like trying to hold that clarity and let it go through me from destabilization to the grounding feeling that you're having, and knowing that that's a part of the process. It's part of humaning. It's part of being human, is to go through that. So I'm trying to let myself feel it and come out on the other end with more and more of that clarity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can't do it alone. You got a good group of people around you.
Amen. You have to. You have to human with other humans. Like, one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is how pushing for change and just living life is like a relay. And there are so many people, I think, if you consider yourself a change maker, a disruptor, a challenger, people go hard and they run fast at the wall of no's that you get when you're pushing for change. Mm. And I tell people, if you are the only one who keeps running and running, you're going to hit that wall. You're going to get injured. Your nose is going to bleed. You're going to get burned out. You have to think of change and courage as a relay. Like, find the other humans with you who you can pass the baton back to once you've run your leg of the relay, and let them run their leg. And then you get back in and you run another leg of the relay, but you can't do it alone.
Why does it sound like I'm thinking of the Audacity of Hope, Barack Obama, or Genes from My Father? It sounds like that would be in that, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And I love that word audacity. It is so akin to just what I'm living and feeling, and what are in the book, the antithesis of nice. People think of as mean, and it's not. I write about it as nerve. And nerve to me is similar to that audacity. And I really believe that life meets you at your level of nerve or audacity.
Look, let's talk about the book. I'm holding here in my hand for our podcast listeners. Be sure to go over to the Nonprofit Insider Podcast on YouTube. You can watch this interview. Amira has a phenomenal outfit on. Go over to YouTube. You're definitely going to want to check that out. You know, there's so much about this book, and being able to read it and consume it. And again, knowing, you know, following you online and Instagram and LinkedIn and stuff like that, I want to take us on a journey. Because again, I think there's so many people that they go to themselves. They want to write that book. They want to share themselves. They want to communicate. And that's what we're talking about, right? Aspects of sharing yourself with others. You can't, you're a human being, not a human doing. Take me into the process of you creating this book. Was there a moment where you told yourself, I'm writing this book, it's gonna be about this? How did it even come to be?
Yeah, there's a very visceral moment sort of seared in my mind. So I've been thinking about this book for years, but I think the moment I decided to write the book came around 2022. So at that time, my daughter was 9 years old then. She's 13 in about 2 weeks. Wild. That's crazy. I can't believe it. But in 2022, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was going through her Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for the first ever Black woman nominated to the Supreme Court. That was a moment, historical, first ever, wild that it was the first ever in 2022, as long as this country has been around. But I wanted my daughter, who is a little Black girl, to watch and see those committee hearings and to experience this moment of history. And so we sat down for the couple of days of the hearings after school and watched it on the YouTube, you know, and in one of the days, she had witnessed then Senator Ted Cruz questioning Ketanji Brown Jackson. And she turned to me and my husband and she said, why does he keep interrupting her? And why isn't anybody doing something about it? This little 9-year-old, you know, recognized that that's not how we talk to people. That's not how we treat people. There's something off here, even if she didn't have all the words for it. And then she asked, you know, can I say a word that I'm not allowed to? And I was very intrigued. So I said, yeah, sure. And she said, well, isn't he kind of being like a jerk? And I chuckled and I was like,
we're going to have to beat that out. Yeah. You can't say that.
right?
Yeah.
And so in that moment, we had a lesson from one of my favorites, Bell Hooks. And one of the things Bell Hooks wrote years ago was about how it's not that people don't see your power. It's actually the opposite, is that they see your power and they don't want it to exist. And that was a lesson that Audrey had that day, and one that took me many adult years to learn. And in many ways, I feel like I wrote this book to answer some of the questions that my then 9-year-old had for me. She recognized in that moment harm that many adults choose to ignore. And I think a lot of that is conditioning. And I knew then that it wasn't just personal, it was systemic, right? And I think nonprofits will understand this and are especially vulnerable to this because goodness sort of becomes a currency in the nonprofit world. Being nice becomes confused with being moral or being good. And so that moment with Audrey really solidified for me, you know, we are so expected, particularly as women, I think, and even more so as Black women, to contort ourselves. And that's what I witnessed with Justice Jackson, was she had to play that game of contorting herself in essentially what was a job interview, right? For her, that the whole world got to see. And we're told to sort of sit pretty, play nice, go along to get along, smile more. And for many of us, particularly if you're a Black person or a Black woman, some of that is survival. Some of that is safety. And there is a part where we have to tap into and choose that for safety. It can be life and death for us. And I don't want that for us. I don't want that for me. I don't want that for you. I don't want that for Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. I don't want that for my daughter. And so this book is sort of crystallizing that moment and some answers that I've accumulated over the years of unpacking the lessons I was handed, which was, you know, nice girls get rewarded, brave girls get punished. And I was taught to shrink, and I was taught to sit pretty and play nice. And I really don't want us to do that anymore.
Yeah, no, I picked once more. Let me pick up the book. I love the cover.
Thank you.
And can I just, I gotta do a little aside here. I love just holding the book. Great feel. You, your publishers, you all did a great job.
Kind of velvety.
Yeah, and the spacing is really good. It's not all cramped in there. It's a great read. And I was like, as you're talking about your daughter, I was like, wait a minute. Open up the book. And you, the first person you acknowledge or dedicate is to 9-year-old you, and then to your daughter. So clearly this is a legacy in the book that you're creating. Does she like the book? Does your daughter like the book?
She does. She was, you know how they say to write to a 6th grade reading level? Because that's where most people can read towards. And at the time when I was writing it, she was in 6th grade. So she was one of my first readers. I would, you know, read her passages or give her a chapter and say, you know, does this make sense? Is there anything that's unclear? What do you have a question about? Or, you know, is that word something that you understand what it means? So she was an early reader, an early test subject of the book, which I loved that I could bring her along on this journey with me to kind of see this come to fruition. And I think it's so important that we do that with this next generation, that they see the ups and downs of building something and bringing something to life. So yes, she loves the book. She went out on the day that it came out to a bookstore. She wanted to buy it physically in person. And so she went to our, you know, local bookstore and she got a copy off the shelf. And it was a really fun and proud moment.
She'll remember that forever. And I want to read a portion of your book right here. Let me turn to page 175. This is actually in the conclusion. So it's like a second to last page. You wrote, nice, it keeps us compliant, comfortable, and complicit in the systems that harm us. The stakes of our compliance are not just stagnation, they're erosion. Erosion of our dignity, erosion of our humanity. Every time we choose palpability over principle, we pay a quiet tax. A little less truth, a little less justice, a little less justice, a little less of ourselves. Dana Litwin of Dana Litwin Consulting. I know you know her. She's been
Yes.
telling people in the nonprofit space, do not comply in advance. Do not comply in advance when it's
Yes.
when referring and talking about the changes that are affecting the industry, like you mentioned earlier, funding, aspects of way we talk about DEI. And this is, of course, coming from the Trump administration. We know what it is. Would you say niceness plays a part in nonprofits complying to these federal changes? Is it more fear? Is it a combination of things? How does it all play together when you think about nonprofits complying to what's happening?
Yeah, it's both, and they feed each other, right? Fear says if we speak up, we'll lose funding or credibility. Niceness says, let's not rock the boat. Let's just go along to get along. And together they produce that pre-compliance, not because people agree with harmful changes, but because they're trying to survive. And nonprofits are often told explicitly or implicitly, be grateful that you're here. Be grateful that you got those dollars. Be grateful that we are allowing you to exist. And that creates a scarcity mindset, and scarcity shrinks courage. And I think a hard truth is that compliance doesn't actually buy safety, right? It buys temporary quiet and comfort, and quiet can look like protection until that erosion, as you just read, sets in. And I use the word erosion intentionally in the book. Erosion doesn't happen all at once, not in nature, not in life. It happens sort of grain by grain, right? And you don't notice it until the foundation is suddenly compromised and there becomes a problem that you have to confront and face head on. And I think the action here is not. It's not reckless rebellion. I think when people hear change or practice nerve, the first thing that comes to mind is like throw the tea into the water, turn over the tables, burn it all down, right? And sometimes that's what we need. We might actually need quite a bit of that right now. But also sometimes the change and the action that we need is it's values anchored decision making, right? Asking what is a non-negotiable for us and our nonprofit, our mission? Where can we adapt without abandoning our mission and the people that come to us and need what we do? And what lines, if crossed, change who we are or who we say we are? And not complying in advance means deciding those answers before the pressure hits. And that's why I started off when you asked me, what am I hearing from people? I mentioned that moral fatigue. And moral fatigue or moral injury is how people might have heard of it. And it was first used to describe soldiers in war. And when soldiers in war would see something happening to their fellow soldiers or even others in the enemy camp, that moral injury is when their deeply held values are pushed up against. And that's so much of what we're seeing right now. That's why I think that values anchored decision making has to be something that we set out to do before the foundation erodes, before the pressure hits, and before we encounter a problem, because that is what will sustain you and anchor you in those moments where a non-negotiable comes to you or you are confronted with that you do not abandon your mission. You do not abandon the people that need what your nonprofit exists to provide and fulfill. Phil.
One more time, shout out to Faiza Van Zandt, CVA, leader of the Council on Certi. You know, I don't remember the what C.
Council for Certification and Volunteer Administration.
I'm like the CCVA. That's how I always recognize it. And it's funny, Faiza was the last interview that I had for 2025, and one of
Yes.
the big questions I asked her was, give a state of the nonprofit. And she gave a nice go back, listen to that episode 70. Yeah, episode 70. But then I also asked her, what is it that she's not liking, or what she's seeing in a nonprofit space that she's not liking? Values was the one she said without hesitation, that
Yeah.
there are people in the nonprofit space that they have a level of values and they're letting that slide. They're letting that erode a little bit because there's a lot of big
Yeah.
factors. You can't win every battle. I get it. But there's a lot of people who are having values that are sliding. So I want to I want to switch up a little bit because I think you bring a level of joy in
Thank
your
you.
words, in your voice, and what you're really talking about. But this is something that is very serious to you. There's a lot of, and you kind of mentioned this in the book, there's a lot of consequences and repercussions when it comes to aspects of what we're talking about and niceness. How do you, Amir, balance that, knowing that this is something that's very serious, but we still have to have joy, we still need to smile, we still need to enjoy the people and the things that are around us, even when we have so much that's really going on.
I love the word harmony versus balance, and I think about living life and finding joy in moments as harmony. Because to me, right, balance, I immediately think of a scale. And to me, harmony is more inclusive of accepting that sometimes there are those feelings of tension, erosion, burnout, sadness, and all of those things. And it's okay to honor those, to feel through them until you get to the grounding, right? Move through the destabilization, get to the grounding. And so harmony to me is something that holds space for the fullness of what we experience and feel versus the balance. And for me, some of where the joy and the harmony comes from is remembering constantly that I'm not doing this work alone, that there are, I believe, so many more of us who want a world where each of us has what we need to thrive, as opposed to the opposite, which I think is the world we have today, where some people have a storehouse of power and resources that aren't being shared and utilized to better their neighbor or the other humans around them. So I practice hope as a discipline, and I learned that from Maryam Kaba, an activist and author, and so many great things, a Black woman who talks about how hope is a discipline. And I think in the world of business and sometimes in nonprofit, you hear that quip saying of hope is not a strategy. And I reject that. I like what Maryam Kaba says about how hope is a discipline, and that hope is actually something that can be part and parcel with strategy, and it's something we need to remember to hold onto. And I think that that's a really beautiful sentiment, but I also think it's a very real one. It's sometimes what sustains us in the midst of moral fatigue, moral injury, burnout, right? Is that we remember that there are people who also want the world that you can imagine and foresee in your mind. And that, I think, is what brings me joy, is each of us really does have the ability and the power to do at least one thing. And that's why I tell people when I talk about change that's needed, progress, or practicing nerve, immediately people's mind does go to like the biggest, loudest, boldest action. And in everyday life, it's not always that. Sometimes it's going next door and checking on your neighbor. Sometimes it is taking some canned goods to the local food pantry. Sometimes it is asking, one more question, or, texting or placing a phone call to someone to see how they're doing, what they need, or how you can be a good friend and a good fellow human. Sometimes those micro actions are exactly the change and the progress that we need. And each of us has the ability to do that, to do one micro action every single day. We can all do that.
Hey, it's Jessica Pang Parks from learnwithjpp.com. Did you catch my conversation with Swim on the Nonprofit Insider podcast a few weeks ago? Check it out now to learn my insights as a volunteer engagement thought leader. As the principal consultant at Learn with JPP, I work with nonprofits who give a care to build trust, create impact, and inspire belonging through ethical volunteer engagement frameworks. Want to jumpstart or grow your volunteer engagement journey? Right now, I'm offering Nonprofit Insider listeners 10% off of my one-on-one coaching sessions. Go to learnwithjpp.com/coaching. That's learnwithjpp.com/coaching and enter InsiderPod at checkout. That's InsiderPod, all one word, on learnwithjpp.com/coaching. This offer applies to the first 5 people who use the code InsiderPod. I'm here to help you solve that urgent challenge you're facing around board member engagement, grow professionally as a leader of volunteers, or realign processes with your organizational values. Go to learnwithjpp.com/coaching and enter InsiderPod, all one word, to claim this exclusive offer.
Once again, I'm joined with Amir Barger. Look at that book. I just love that cover. There's just something about that cover. It really captures it captures you. Phenomenal picture of you on the back. That is That is high level. I love this book.
I like it too.
Yeah, this is phenomenal. I want to get you out of here soon, but I got a couple more questions here. Burnout.
Yep.
You and I hear from so many people in the nonprofit space about burnout. And I truly believe it's very unique to the nonprofit space. There's that connection, of course, to the mission, trying to better the world around us outside of a profit. And it's so much different compared to people in the for-profit and the government space. Mm-hmm. To what degree do you think the price of nice plays in nonprofit burnout, if at all?
I think that niceness and our obsession with it culturally accelerates that harm, because niceness asks people, it asks too much of us, right? It asks us to shrink ourselves. It asks us to wear a mask, which is one of the reasons the cover is what it is of the book. Is I did a community survey, and this is the one that stopped people in their tracks of, I lived my life wearing a mask and performing, if you will, for too long. And that's sort of what this cover represents. Niceness asks us also to absorb disrespect quietly. It asks us to normalize under-resourcing. It asks us to accept urgency without authority to actually do the things we're tasked to do. And it asks us to treat self-sacrifice as a virtue, I think, especially in the nonprofit sector, right? There's that nonprofit tax of, you know, we're the nice sector and we should just be grateful to have a job. We shouldn't expect to be paid a living wage. We shouldn't expect to be treated well. And that's not resilience, right? That's erosion. And it's disguised, I think, in this sector of nonprofits as dedication. We're expected to be dedicated despite the erosion that we are experiencing, or even some of the disrespect. And I think nonprofit burnout, I think of it like running a marathon again, or a relay, where the finish line just keeps moving and you're told, smile while running faster, even though the finish line keeps smiling, just keep going. And the price of nice is paid in sleeplessness, cynicism, health issues, attrition in our sector, which is an issue. And we lose our best people in nonprofits, not because they stop caring, not at all. They never stop caring. I've never met one who has. But I think we lose our best people because they care so much in systems that don't in turn protect or care for them as much as we often care for the people and community that need the whole reason for why our nonprofits exist. And I think that's one of the things that I realized and how I got burnt out when I was in the nonprofit sector. We did such a beautiful job of seeing the humans and people in community and meeting their needs. We didn't often take those same principles and tools and outlook inward of, what do our people need? How can we care for them? How can we treat them in the ways that they need to be the best humans that they can be? And that's where I think so much of the burnout in the sector comes from, is we're so externally focused that we are not of use internally to our people who need to be sustained in order to keep fulfilling the mission of the organization. And I think we set ourselves aside too much. And I think that's really harmful.
Yeah, like when you talked about that sacrifice, I know I never actually even thought of it, to be completely honest. Doing this podcast for all these years, being in the nonprofit space, I never thought about how much people can sacrifice in the name of nonprofits. And I think a lot of people in the nonprofit industry take advantage of that. A lot of organizations, not intentionally, but they take advantage of that when it comes to things like pay, time, career advancement, mentorship, things that are tangible and sometimes not quite as easily tangible.
Exactly. We've normalized it a little too much. And that's why, like you said, it's not always conscious or intentional. Mm-hmm. It's just become so normalized. And we've got to start pushing back and asking different questions to, you know, unnormalize it.
And one of the things with this book is communication is such a major piece. I mean, even in the first like 10 paragraphs, you tell a great story about the twins. I won't ruin it. And the aspects of communication. And I think when people hear the title of this book, they may not be sure how to step out of the comfort zone to properly communicate in a fashion that is not cliche niceness. You know, that makes sense. So when keeping the core message of your book front and center, how can people communicate in a fashion that's not just playing nice, but addressing what needs to be addressed?
You know, one of the things I train people to and talk about when I'm out, you know, thinking about nice versus nervous, you know, when it comes to communications, replace politeness with precision. I think that's the simplest way to put it. Nice communication avoids tension. Effective communication, precise communication seeks to reduce harm. And so that means, like, name the issue clearly. Right? Separate tone from truth. Oftentimes people will tone police others. And, you know, you have to, as a leader and a manager, be really wise to be able to say, okay, even if the tone was off, what is the content of what they were saying or sharing? Like, what is the main thing here? And how can we work towards that? You know, saying the quiet part out loud without cruelty is something we can do. And a simple shift is replacing, you know, statements with anchored questions. I talk in the book a lot about using inquiry as a strategy. So asking things like, you know, what problem are we actually solving for? Or who bears the cost of this decision? Meaning who's going to be most impacted by what we decide in this room? And when we walk out of this room, do we understand the impact on those humans? What would alignment with our mission require here? That's a good anchored question. And I think another is learning clean interruptions, right? That's a good skill for anyone, but especially leaders, like something as simple as, you know what, I want to pause this right there. You know, what you just said or the question that you just asked, I want to pause there. That bears, you know, digging deeper. Or can we name the assumption behind that, right? When someone makes a statement or a declarative decision, can we name the assumptions behind that? Like, what are the factors that you're thinking of? Can we name it out loud? Or even something as simple as like, I'm concerned about the impact, not just the intent, right? So as you're having conversations or making decisions, learn how to cleanly sort of interrupt in a way that gets people's curiosity jogged in the room and in the conversation. And that's not being the opposite of nice. That's not being unkind. I think that that's being responsible. And that's what I mean by replace politeness with precision is be responsible enough to have effective communication that works towards reducing harm. And there are moments where that might feel poignant. It might feel direct and people might feel like the tone is off. But I always ask myself at the end of the day, but did we create progress? Did we move forward? Did we take one more step forward despite the fact that it might have ruffled some feathers? And one of my favorite metaphors for the difference between nice and kind or nice and nerve is someone said it's the difference between a Californian and a New Yorker. And I agree. And so the analogy is that, let's say it's winter, you're about to have a winter storm, a snow day, you mentioned, and it's cold outside and you're walking outside, you forgot a jacket and you pass a Californian on the street and you say out loud, oh my gosh, I'm so cold, I forgot a jacket. A Californian might say, oh, that's really sad, I'm so sorry that you're cold, and move on. A New Yorker, if you say the same thing, oh my gosh, it's so cold, I forgot a jacket, a New Yorker will look at you with scowl and say, you're so dumb. How could you leave the house? How could you leave the house without a jacket? What is wrong with you? And then they will take their jacket off of their back and hand it to you. Were they a little gruff and rough around the edges in their tone and their message delivery? Sure. But are you cold? Did they also give you the jacket off of their back? Right? The Californian focused on like nice words and some empathy, sure. Performative. They didn't actually take any action to help you. The New Yorker, tone, whatever, but you're not cold. Progress has been had. Change has been made. Action was taken. You're not cold. And I think that matters more than the tone that they used.
One more time. Amir Barger, pick up this book. I got one more question I want to get you out of here. But tell people, where can they pick up the book? How can they grab this thing?
AmiraBarger.com. You can find all the links to wherever you like to buy books, from Barnes & Noble to Bookshop to independent bookstores and whatnot. And I am also on all the socials. I keep it simple. It's at Amira Barger on Instagram, TikTok, Blue Sky, you name it. And I'm active there with lots of fun resources, videos, tips and tricks, all related back to how to practice nerve versus nice. So AmiraBarger.com is where you can find me and all of the resources.
This thing is a good book. I love this. You talked about the anchor questions. I wasn't thinking about that with our questions, but it was actually one of my favorite parts, the anchor questions.
Nice.
You really do such an amazing job of really being able to use those anchor questions. I think you were talking to, might have been Toby Johnson on her episode, and you talked about you. She said she was going to use it in a meeting, or she had used it in a meeting.
Love
so
it.
People are really rocking with it. I want to, just for the last question, I want to switch it up here. I had a question. Yeah. I want to get rid of that. I want to ask the final question here. Take the next 30 seconds. Look at our audience here. Again, if you're listening to this on the podcast, go ahead, jump over to YouTube. You're going to want to listen in on this. If you had 30 seconds to talk to someone, they're looking, they're in the nonprofit space, you know, and they're at the bookstore, they're thinking about picking up the book, and they're kind of hesitant. What would you tell that person? Hey, grab that book. I mean, I get it, self-promotion, but what would you say to that person that's on the fence about picking up your book?
Ooh, on the fence about picking up the book. I would say that... That's such a good question. I really like this. That niceness is a social contract, and I describe it as a velvet glove over an iron fist. And the way I talk about niceness, it really is a problem. And I think that so much more of what we need today is more people to have the audacity, to have the nerve, to say the quiet parts out loud, and to stop shrinking. And I think that's exactly what people want today, is to not shrink anymore, is to have deeper and better conversations and changed patterns. So this is a book for anyone and with influence, not just authority. And you have influence in your home, with your kids, in your workplace, with your partner, with your relationships. You have influence somewhere. Someone out there needs the nerve that you are going to show up with in the world. They don't need niceness. Stop being nice.
I'm thinking about, this is so random, but I'm thinking about when people go to the mechanic, and you go for the oil change, and they're like, oh, we can change your filters and stuff like that. And I have a friend, I'm not gonna name her. I know her very well. She's like, oh, I didn't want to be rude, so I just said, yeah, sure, whatever, $40 later, when in reality, it could have been like a New Yorker. Hey, why do you need to do that? Explain just a little bit more before I agree to that, and taking a little bit of boldness within themselves in those types of moments. Sounds like it can go a long way.
Absolutely. It can. Just might change the world.
Well, one more time. Amir Barger is here. Amir, what's next for you? Do you got a second book coming, or what's going on? What's up?
Of course. Always thinking about what's next. Thinking about a companion book where I gave 12 promising practices in this book, but going deeper with people of, okay, but how do I really practice nerve? How do I do that day to day, not just in the workplace, but just in the world, in every space you enter? So a little bit more of a workbook, and maybe that workbook comes with some workshops or some one-on-one coaching. Who knows? So always thinking about the next book. That's for sure. There's something coming.
Well, we appreciate you being on the podcast. We know you have a lot of people behind you that are there for you, rooting, because you've been there for them. And so we're excited to have you here. Don't forget about us, because listen, in 2 years, when Oprah calls for the book club, we want you back here on the podcast. We'd love to have you again whenever.
You know it. Anytime.
All right. One more time. Be sure to go over to YouTube if you're listening to this on the podcast. If you're listening on the YouTube, go over to the podcast. Follow us there. We're going to have all the links in the show notes. And we appreciate everything that you all are doing out there in the nonprofit space. It's 2026. Let's have a kick-ass year. Amir, it's good to see you. We'll see you on the next one.
Likewise.
Thank you.